This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 28, 2008. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram. 18,000 flee Johannesburg as xenophobic violence continues. Human rights and environmental activists blast Chevron at its annual meeting. Human Rights First says domestic civilian courts can handle terrorism cases better than military commissions. And we'll take a look at California's Proposition 98. Is it anti-eminent domain? All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. New Pentagon data shows the number of combat veterans diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder increased by nearly 50% last year. The military data puts the total number of Iraq and Afghan war veterans with PTSD at nearly 40,000. However, the report only calculates the number of U.S. veterans diagnosed with PTSD at military facilities. Many more combat veterans are thought to keep their symptoms secret for fear of damaging their careers. The new military statistics do not include troops who have sought private medical care. In election news, a federal judge has thrown out another lawsuit aimed at forcing the Democratic National Committee to seat Florida's presidential delegates. Mitch Perry reports from WMNF in Tampa.
U.S. District Court Judge Richard Wazzaro said the latest lawsuit from Democratic Party activist Vic DiMaio failed to show how the DNC's refusal to seat Florida's delegates constitutes discrimination. The judge said it's up to the Democratic Party to resolve its own internal dispute. DiMaio filed the lawsuit claiming that the DNC practiced reverse discrimination by letting South Carolina and Nevada hold early primaries based on their large percentages of African American and Latino voters. But Judge Lazzaro rejected that claim, saying there was no connection between money given to the DNC and alleged discriminatory practices. Vic DiMaio, a Democratic Party political consultant, said he will not be satisfied with the potential compromise rumored to come out of a Democratic Rules and Bylaws Committee meeting this weekend.
The fact that the Democratic National Committee has chosen to punish me as a Florida voter, I mean, what am I supposed to do? I did exactly what the state of Florida asked me to do. I went to vote on January 29th. That was the law. That's what the state of Florida said to do. And I did my part.
Last year, the DNC stripped all of Florida's delegates to the National Convention as a penalty for moving up its primary date. In response to this dismissal of his latest lawsuit, DiMaio says he intends to appeal to the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is facing mounting pressure to resign. The latest calls for Olmert's resignation come from his own cabinet. Defense Minister Ehud Barak, himself a former prime minister, told a news conference today that Olmert must disconnect himself from the daily running of government, pending the outcome of an ongoing corruption probe. Olmert has been accused of accepting bribes and illegal campaign donations in the form of cash-stuffed envelopes. Nepal's new Constituent Assembly has officially abolished the country's monarchy, despite marathon delays at its first formal meeting today. PC Dubey has more.
The internal debates over the division of power within the new government delayed the start of the Constituent Assembly's first meeting by over 10 hours. This enraged a crowd of people that had gathered outside of the meeting to celebrate the official declaration to abolish the monarchy. The abolition of the monarchy was to be the first order of business for today's meeting. Restless demonstrators began throwing stones at police guarding the venue, resulting in minor skirmishes and some injuries on both sides. Adding to the unrest, two small bombs detonated near the site of the meeting and another exploded a few kilometers away, injuring five people. A previously little-known Hindu pro-monarchy group called Ranveer Sena claimed responsibility for today's blast. The group also detonated three explosives yesterday during the Constituent Assembly's swearing-in ceremony. This had led to fears that pro-monarchy elements could stir up more trouble in the coming days, despite the heavy security operation in effect throughout Kathmandu. I'm PC Dubey for FSRN.
In Pakistan, eight Taliban militants, including a top local commander, were killed in an accidental blast in the tribal region near the Afghan border. Rahman Ullah reports.
Top Taliban commander Qari Saqib was among the eight killed in the blast that left two others injured. A local official said the explosion occurred on board a vehicle carrying Taliban members from the Bajol agency to Afghanistan. One version is that explosives carried in the truck accidentally detonated while the militants traveled along a rough road. Another version suggests the vehicle hit a planted landmine along the way. Confirming what actually happened has proven difficult, as local Taliban forces quickly cordoned off the blast site. The Pakistani government has agreed to a ceasefire with Taliban militants in the tribal areas. While the move has reduced the number of attacks within Pakistan, the US military has strongly criticized the ceasefire, saying that it allows the local Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces to carry out more cross-border attacks on NATO-led troops in Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rahmanullah in Peshawar, Pakistan.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
After the September 11th attacks, President Bush authorized the use of military commissions to prosecute terrorism cases. These special military courts have faced repeated legal challenges and were even overturned by the Supreme Court. The White House is still struggling to make these courts fully operational, but according to a report released by Human Rights First, existing federal courts are the more appropriate venue. Free Speech Radio News' Najee Mujahid reports from Washington, D.C.
According to Human Rights First, the U.S. judicial system is able to handle alleged terrorism cases. Some of the criticisms that have been argued against the U.S. courts as being a viable resource include the possible disclosure of classified information during court proceedings, the difficulty of having to give detainees their Miranda rights, and the chain of custody in keeping defendants. In their report, the authors examine over 100 international terrorism cases that have been prosecuted in U.S. courts over the past 15 years. The paper concludes that the court system in place is generally well-equipped to handle most terrorism cases. Richard Zabel, co-author of the report.
If you look at the paper and read the paper, you will see certainly a more well-defined area and body of data and experience on how even very, very complex and difficult cases that I think many years ago people wouldn't have imagined could have been prosecuted in the criminal justice system can be.
Elisa Massimino, the Washington director of Human Rights First, acknowledged that the federal system is flawed, but insisted that it would be better than the military commissions as well as the proposed national security courts.
The distinction between that system, flawed though it may be, and I don't think anybody would say it's perfect, and a system like we have at Guantanamo is at least there is an independent check on the abuse of power within that system by any particular actor, by the judicial branch. That's something you do not have in the military system, and it's something that's unclear whether you'd have in any new system that's being proposed.
In the military commission system, detainees have limited rights. For example, in many cases aren't able to see the evidence used against them. The Supreme Court ordered Congress to fix the detainees' court system. Congress did make changes, but a new challenge is currently pending before the High Court. The president of Human Rights First points out that since 9/11, the court system created by the U.S. has failed to complete even one trial of alleged terrorist detainees and has only resolved one case of the detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. Last week, a military commission began proceeding against several detainees. So far, one of them, Mohammed Kamin, has rejected the court. He called it unfair and alleged that he had been abused. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Najee Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Human rights and environmental activists from around the world descended on oil giant Chevron Corporation's annual stockholder meeting today. They came from Nigeria, Burma, Ecuador, and Richmond, California, to testify about the company's involvement in pollution and human rights abuses. The coalition asked the company's shareholders to vote for a series of resolutions to clean up its operations and to create an international human rights policy. Brian Edwards Tiekert reports from the meeting in San Ramon, California.
Chevron, get off it! It's all about your profit!
The morning started with a protest at the gates of Chevron's world headquarters. About 100 people turned out, half of them clad in mock hazmat suits and carrying hand-lettered signs listing their grievances with the oil giant. As the shareholder meeting approached, a small group of activists, many in the U.S. for the first time in their lives, broke off to head inside. Brant Olson is a campaigner for Rainforest Action Network.
The last vestige of democracy left in the corporate world is the annual shareholder meeting.
The activists had enlisted support of some socially responsible pension funds and investment firms to propose six shareholder resolutions at the meeting. One asks Chevron to set greenhouse gas goals. Another asks the company to draft a policy on human rights. Others asked the company to produce reports on the environmental laws of the countries it operates in and on its criteria for choosing the governments that it will work with. All were opposed by the company's board and management. Chevron spokesperson Kent Robertson.
We are in a situation where we don't get to choose where energy resources are. We have to go to those locations. We believe that we're in a leadership role in the job that we do. We do so in an environmentally appropriate fashion.
The opposition from Chevron's management and board virtually guaranteed that each shareholder resolution would fail. Again, Rainforest Action Network campaigner Brant Olson.
That's sort of the hitch in socially responsible investing. When the management of a company recommends a vote against a particular issue, you're nearly guaranteed that that issue is not going to pass.
Olson says the point of the shareholder resolutions isn't necessarily to pass them, but to confront a corporation's board and executives face-to-face at the one event per year where they have to meet with the public, which is exactly what happened. Human rights activists from Burma testified in the meeting that Chevron's stake in that country's natural gas pipeline is financing its repressive military junta. Indigenous activists from the Ecuadorian Amazon testified about the impacts of living on top of toxic waste, a situation they blame on Texaco, which Chevron subsequently purchased. And representatives from Nigeria accused Chevron of being complicit in pollution and human rights abuses. Nigerian journalist Omoyele Sowore.
For me, it is a red letter day because I read to Mr. O'Reilly a letter written in the blood of villagers in Nigeria who has been harmed, killed, murdered, and whose environment has been destroyed by Chevron.
That testimony met with a sharp rebuttal from the chair of Chevron's board, David O'Reilly. There was no recording allowed in the meeting, but spokesperson Kent Robertson explained the company's position afterwards. He says that Chevron was taking appropriate action against an indigenous group occupying one of its drilling platforms.
They roughed up workers. They claim to have been unarmed. There's firsthand accounts that suggest to the contrary. And now they've arrived here to suggest that somehow Chevron is in the wrong for seeking the government's assistance in resolving a dangerous situation.
That resolution climaxed in Nigerian forces who'd flown into the platform on a helicopter owned by Chevron, shooting two of the protesters. Omoyele Sowore took sharp exception to the allegation that those protesters were acting criminally.
The truth is that the only criminal we have seen as proven by several human rights reports around the world, by several pronouncements or even law courts, is Chevron. They are not only guilty in Nigeria, they are guilty in Ecuador, they are guilty in Burma, where they are in bed with one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world as of today. They are guilty right here in Richmond, where they are polluting the air you breathe.
Sowore says Chevron's alleged abuses in Nigeria will go to trial in a San Francisco court this fall. Every shareholder resolution failed, but with enough support to guarantee each one of them a spot on the agenda at next year's meeting. From Pacifica Station KPFA, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert in San Ramon.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News online at fsrn.org.
More than 18,000 people have fled xenophobic violence around Cape Town since mobs began attacking foreigners and burning and looting their homes and businesses 1 week ago. Thousands more were chased out of their homes in the central Gauteng province in the previous week. At least 42 have been killed in and around Gauteng's capital, Johannesburg. The national total will be significantly higher. Police in Cape Town have not released casualty figures, saying they don't have separate records for xenophobia-related murders. Tana Gusey reports from a shelter in Cape Town.
The scene is peaceful enough. Children are playing in the front of the church hall by the stage. One of their mothers is serving rice and beans and chicken from the kitchen. But in the corner, Annie, Sophie and Marie, three quiet, watchful Congolese women, and hardly anyone with a foreign accent is using their full names in Cape Town this week. The women recount several days of terror. Marie fled her home in the Cape Flats township of Philippi on Friday, May 23rd, driven out by her neighbors. She was caught and raped, but escaped and fled the township. With the assistance of a passing stranger, she made her way to the relative safety of the central business district. There, in the midst of Cape Town's crowded bus and train terminus, the group of refugees she joined was stalked through rush hour crowds by a group of four black men, while they desperately tried to find someone to take them to a shelter they'd heard about. Eventually, a color driver agreed to take them, but the men who'd been following jumped into another minibus and tailed them. Afraid of leading possible attackers to their place of refuge and fearing for their driver's safety, they stopped at a police station in Woodstock. But here, a black police officer refused to let them in, ordering them to stop speaking Lingala amongst themselves. Lingala is widely spoken across the Democratic Republic of Congo. "Speak English," she said, "or speak our local language, Xhosa." Meanwhile, their four pursuers drove slowly past, turned around somewhere out of sight, and drove past again. Eventually, another officer intervened and let them inside. They were transported to the church where they're staying now. The violence has been explained as stemming from deep poverty and frustration in South Africa's townships. Rioters have accused migrants of stealing their jobs, houses, and women. Xenophobia is a long-recognized problem in South Africa, but in Cape Town this week, it has also been cover for opportunistic looting and sexual assault. It has left refugees like Papi Luindula in despair.
Homeless, we don't have place to stay. Now we're just living by the church now. We leave our house. We lost everything, I'm telling you, everything. We're just like this because we ran away from the xenophobic attack that is happening by the location area. So my point is, we just need to move out of this country.
Many of the migrants in the camp say they want to leave, and thousands have already returned to Mozambique and Malawi. But many others from Zimbabwe or the DRC cannot go back to their countries of origin. But they insist they won't stay here any longer. The government is largely silent on what comes next. Various departments are still struggling to properly establish immediate relief, shelter, food, housing for the refugees. National and provincial governments insist that migrants must reintegrate into society. Township residents are belatedly finding their voice. Gwebin Konde was at a march staged by the South African Communist Party through one of the worst affected areas on Sunday.
We have to defend anybody who's discriminated, either on the basis of race or nationality. There is no place for that in this country.
At a community meeting afterwards, speaker after speaker expressed regret for what has happened. Community leaders from another township, Masipumelele, have visited refugees and shelters to apologize and to ask them to return. First steps, perhaps, but a long road lies ahead to rebuild the shattered confidence of migrants to South Africa. For FSRN in Cape Town, South Africa, this is Tina Gusey.
Thank you.
Voters in California will decide whether to eliminate all rent control laws in the state when they go to the polls on June 3rd. Proposition 98 was placed on the ballot and has been advertised as a law that would prevent the seizure of private property by the government using the power of eminent domain. But Prop 98 has been labeled a hidden agenda scheme by tenant groups and faces bipartisan opposition who claim the measure, if passed, could force thousands of people to move and would reshape the population centers of the state. From Oakland, Andrew Stelzer has a story.
For more than 1 million Californians, rent increases are limited by law to around 3% annually, depending on the cost of living. 73-year-old Jean Kaiser, who's been using a wheelchair since she suffered polio as a child, is one of those people.
I had to get hearing aids recently. That means my expenses are greater than my income.
Kaiser pays $1,100 a month for an apartment in the Piedmont neighborhood of Oakland, which she shares with her in-home caretaker.
So in that case, I have to make arrangements. I need to pay it off over time, or maybe making a short-term loan from my friend and just having my fingers crossed that it doesn't go up too much more.
If Proposition 98 passes, rent control will still apply to current tenants like Kaiser. Only new tenants will be subject to increased rents. But Prop 98 undermines many tenant protections, leaving renters more vulnerable to eviction. After evicting tenants, landlords will be able to raise rents without restriction. However, the ad campaign supporting Proposition 98 does not address rent control and tenant protection. It's focused on seizures of property by government using eminent domain.
We have to move.
What? Why? Where are we going to go?
Mom says the city is taking our home.
Why? Why would they do that?
They want to build a mall.
The Proposition 98 campaign also attacks Proposition 99, a countermeasure which would protect property owners against eminent domain seizures but wouldn't touch rent control laws.
Only Proposition 98 stops politicians from seizing homes, businesses, rentals, farms, and places of worship and then giving them to developers. The other proposition is a sham put up by politicians and developers to trick voters.
At the end of the ad, a key supporter's name is mentioned.
Vote yes on Proposition 98, the best yes.
Paid for by a coalition of Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, funded by its known tax.
The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is the main group behind Prop 98. The Jarvis Association has shaped California social policy since 1978 when it financed the successful Proposition 13, capping property taxes. The resulting loss in state revenue led to defunding of California's schools and social services. Jarvis has teamed up with landlord and other property owner groups who've raised over $4 million to promote 98. Tenant groups and allies concerned about the impact of the elimination of rent control have raised about the same amount for the countermeasure. In 1994, Massachusetts voters abolished rent control laws statewide. Michael Kane, the executive director of the Massachusetts Alliance of Housing and Urban Development Tenants, says rents doubled in Boston after rent control was eliminated.
The effect is that renters are simply paying a higher percentage of their income for rent.
Developers had claimed that ending rent control would stimulate construction of affordable housing, but according to Kane, there's been no increase. Instead,
there's an increased amount of doubling up and tripling up, and the phenomenon of homelessness has only gotten worse.
Here in California, polls show both 98 and 99 lacking a majority of support. But the head of the Oakland Tenants Union says that urban voters, many of them renters, will need to turn out in large numbers to defeat 98. The eminent domain measures are seen as attractive to suburban and rural voters who more often don't rent and traditionally turn out in greater numbers to vote in the June primary. For FSRN, from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
According to a field poll released today, for the first time in over three decades, more California voters approve of extending marriage to gay couples than disapprove. Despite this trend, shortly after last week's landmark ruling by the California Supreme Court that upheld the right of same-sex couples to marry, some officials in Southern California took steps to avoid performing the civil marriages. Dan Fritz has more from KPFK in Los Angeles.
San Diego County Clerk Greg Smith says he will allow clerks who have, quote, moral and religious objections to gay marriage not to officiate them. Smith refused a request for an interview for this story, and the San Diego County Department of Media and Public Relations also declined to comment beyond a spokesperson saying Smith, quote, is an elected official and speaks for himself. Director of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center, Lori Jean, predicted opposition when the mostly Republican-appointed California Supreme Court voted 4-3 to uphold gay marriage rights.
Right-wing extremist forces, mostly from outside of our state, are trying to put a measure on the ballot that would take away our right to marry.
That measure, the California Marriage Protection Act, is being sponsored by ProtectMarriage.com. Another website that just closed its own proposition campaign due to insufficient funds, VoteYesMarriage.com, is actively encouraging clerks to refuse to issue marriage licenses. Martin Fisher with the Florida-based Christian Action Network says the issue here is religious freedom.
These public servants are recognizing from their own point of view that there are religious freedom issues that are being stepped upon.
The new procedures for same-sex marriage will not be finalized and ready until as early as Saturday, June 14th. John Davidson is legal director of Lambda Legal, one of the plaintiffs in the California Supreme Court ruling. He says he does not expect clerk refusals to be an issue here.
What we've seen in other places where same-sex couples have been allowed to marry, in Massachusetts, Canada, several other countries, is there haven't been large numbers of people who have refused to do their job. I think most people would agree that it's wrong for a government employee to treat people unequally. And we think that applies here. A government official could not refuse to officiate at a wedding because the couple was interracial or of different faiths. Government officials are expected to do their jobs. Firefighter couldn't refuse to put out a fire at a house because he had moral objections to the people in the house. It's no different here.
In 2005, pharmacists around the country refused to fill prescriptions for RU486, the so-called morning-after pill that opponents say induce abortion. Legislators in several states have passed bills to shield healthcare workers from taking part in procedures that violate their religious beliefs. Fisher with the Christian Action Network says there may be a related case here.
I would hope that there would be legal protections for those with religious objections like that.
Lambda Legal's Davidson notes that the cases here are legally very different. There may be a case for religious exceptions when it comes to medical procedures. However, not to discriminate against certain people receiving those procedures, or for that matter, a marriage license.
They don't allow a pharmacist, for example, to say, I will not give RU46 to a white woman, but I will to black women because I think they shouldn't have children. You might be able to treat differently a procedure or a medicine, but not the people to whom you give it. Similarly, a clerk might say, I don't want to do any marriages. Please remove me from that duty. But they don't have the right to decide which marriages they're going to officiate at and which they won't officiate at based on their own personal attitudes.
ProtectMarriage.com claims they have submitted more than enough signatures to qualify for the November ballot. If that measure passes, redefining marriage in the California Constitution as being between a man and a woman, the legal situation for the potentially thousands of same-sex couples who marry before then is unclear. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dan Fritz.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can find us online at fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Kristen Schwartz and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our technical team includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.